This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Elijah of Buxton by Christopher Paul Curtis. Read for you by Myron Willis. Chapter 1. Snakes and Maw. It was Sunday after church, and all my chores were done. I was sitting on the stoop of our home trying to think what to do. It was that time of day when the birds were getting ready to be quiet, and the toady frogs were starting to get louder with that chirpity sound they make most of the night. I wondered if it would be worth it to go fishing for an hour before it got dark. I got that question answered when Cuda came walking up the road waving at me.
"Evening, Eli."
"Evening, Cuda."
"What you doing, Eli?"
"I was thinking about getting old Flapjack and going fishing. You want to come?"
"Uh-uh. I got something that's more interesting than watching you fish. I got a mystery."
"This might not be so good. I ain't trying to be disrespectful about my best friend. But there are lots of things that Cuda sees as being mysterious that most folks understand real easy. I asked him anyway, what's the mystery?"
"I was cutting through Medea's truck patch and seen some tracks that I ain't never seen afore."
"Well, what kind of tracks? Were they big?"
"Uh-uh. They's long and wiggly. I followed them, but they disappeared in the grass."
"Cuda's pretty good at tracking, so maybe this was a mystery after all. Let's go." We got to Cuda's home, opened the gate, and went round back to his mother's truck patch. Cuda was right. There, amongst the rows of his ma's beets and corn and green peas, were some of the strangest markings I'd ever seen. I studied them real close. They were long and skinny, and in six wiggling lines. Two of them were a good bit thicker than the rest. They started on one side of Cuda's ma's truck patch, went clean through her vegetables, then disappeared in the grass. I got on my hands and knees to really give him the eye, then told Cuda,
"You got me. I ain't never seen such tracks nowhere.
Let's ask my pa once he comes out the field." But before we had a chance to ask pa, the preacher came walking down the road in front of Cuda's. He ain't at all like a common preacher that's got a church or nothing, but he tells anyone that will listen that he's the Right Reverend Deacon Dr. Zephariah Connerly III, and that he's the most educated, smartest man anywhere around. Instead of saying all those names, me and Cuda just call him the preacher. He leaned on Cuda's fence and called,
"Evening, boys."
"Evening, sir."
"Hot one today. Why aren't you two off swimming?"
Cuda said,
"We trying to solve us a mystery, sir." "Really? And what would that be?"
I told him,
"It's some kind of animal tracks we ain't never seen afore, sir."
"Where are they?" The preacher opened the gate, walked into the truck patch, squatted down, and peered at the tracks just as sharp as I'd done. He took a jackknife out of his pocket and dug a little scoop of dirt out of one of the tracks. He looked at it so close that his eyes started to go crossed. I quit breathing, and my blood ran cold when all of a sudden he shouted, "Lord, have mercy!" The preacher quick stood up and looked all around him the way you would if someone screamed out, "Wolf!" Me and Cuda looked too. Who wouldn't have? The preacher said, like he's talking to himself,
"No, no, no. I knew this was going to happen. I just prayed it wouldn't be this soon."
Me and Cuda called out together, "What? What was going to happen?" The preacher looked like his best friend just got killed.
"I warned them they had to check out those new free folks better. And now somebody's accidentally toted some of those horrible creatures up here."
I noticed that instead of folding up his knife, the preacher kept it open. Then worst, he held on to it like he was fixing to stab something. I said, "What somebody towed up here, sir?"
"Hoop snakes."
He said it in a low, hissing way that told you whatever kind of snake this was, you didn't want to run up on one. Cooter's eyes scanned right and left.
"What? What's a hoop snake, sir?"
Being any kind of snake was enough for me to start getting nervous. But the preacher made matters a whole lot worse when he said, "I suppose I have to tell you, but I don't want this to get any further than the three of us." He used his boot to rub most of the tracks out of the dirt. I said, "Please, sir, tell us what you mean." The preacher started talking but never looked at me direct. He was too busy eyeing the road in the woods.
"Down home, there's a vile breed of snake called a hoop snake. Not only can it outrun a racehorse, it's been known to kill a fully grown bear with one bite."
I looked at Cooter and hoped that I weren't looking scared as him. The preacher went on.
"They look like near any other snake, except for one thing."
"What?"
"They have the habit of sticking their tails in their mouths, then biting themselves."
That don't make no sense. That don't make no sense at all. If what the preacher was saying was true, these snakes sure ain't too sharp-minded. I said, "How they gonna bite you if they're clapping down on their own tails, sir?"
"Good question, Elijah. But they don't hold their tails when they're ready to bite. They hold them when they're ready to chase after you."
Cooter said,
"But..." The preacher held up his left hand. "Listen. And my young brothers, you better listen good. This may save your lives. Once they've bitten their tails, they form the shape of a circle, then stand up like a wheel or a barrel hoop and commence rolling after whatever they've decided to kill."
The hairs on the back of my neck started jumping like a skeeter brushed up against them. The preacher said,
"After they catch you and bite you..."
He snapped his left hand shut like it was the mouth of one of those hoop snakes.
"The true horror begins. You're doomed."
Cooter said,
"How come?" "Because, Cooter, their poison gets into your blood too quick. Within hours you commence swelling till your skin looks soft and rotten as a ripe peach left in the noonday sun."
Cooter said, "What? You swells up?" The preacher said,
"You swell so much that after exactly 7.5 days, the pressure in your body becomes too great, and you explode like an overheated steam boiler. In seconds, your stomach and your lungs and your other entrails are flung around you for miles and miles."
I couldn't believe folks who got free would do this to us, even if it was an accident. But the preacher weren't through.
"Worse, the swelling affects everything but your head. So you're forced to watch the whole tragedy unwinding right in front of your eyes."
Cooter edged close to me and choked out,
"Well, sir, at least you die as quick and ain't left to do much suffering." "No such luck, Cooter."
The preacher held up two fingers.
2 weeks. It's 14 endless days after your explosion before you pass on. And it's no pleasant death either. You finally die from starvation."
Cooter said, "Starvation? How come you don't eat nothing, sir?"
"Because, Cooter, no matter how much food you swallow, it simply falls through the hole where your internal organs used to be and drops to the ground right in front of you."
The preacher stared hard in the direction the tracks were headed and said,
"Those tracks were fresh. Looks like a mama and a papa and a slew of babies, which, God bless us all, means we're too late. They've already started breeding, and from the way those tracks were going, I'd say they're hungry and have started up a hoop snake hunting party."
The preacher throwed his knife into the ground where the tracks used to be and put his hand on the fancy holster and mystery pistol he always totes. "Boys," he whispered, "I need you to solemnly promise me something. I want you both to swear on your mother's lives that if I'm ever bitten by one of these beasts, you'll take this pistol and put a bullet in my brain. I'd rather be shot dead than face such a horrible, prolonged death. Raise your hands. I need each of you to promise that you'll blow my head right off my shoulders." I near jumped to the moon when a loud bang came from behind me. I looked back, and Cootit already run into his house and slammed and locked the door. He wasn't about to promise nothing. Before I knew what was happening, I was through Cootit's gate and right in the middle of a good, long, hard run home. I had sense enough not to take no shortcuts and stuck to the road so as I could at least see the hoofsnake hunting party if I ran up on it. Ma must have heard me screaming from a ways off, 'cause she was running out our front gate by the time I got there. She said, "Lijah, what on God's earth is wrong now?" I busted through the gate, pulled Ma into the house, and slammed the door behind her. I was too worn out and shook up to talk, so she started looking me up and down and spinning me around to try and figure out what was wrong. After a second, she said, "Lijah, sweetheart, you scared me to death. What's wrong, baby?" Once my breathing caught up with me, I let her know about how the runaways from America had accidentally brung hoop snakes up to Buxton, and how they were out in the woods rolling around looking for something to kill. Ma looked at me like I was daft. She shook her head and said, Lijah, what am I going to do about you? How many times I got to tell you? A coward die 1,000 deaths. A brave boy don't die but once." I didn't say nothing, but I couldn't help wondering how that's supposed to be comforting. Seems to me after you die the first time, the ones that follow ain't gonna really matter too much. I said, "But Ma, I ain't looking to die even one time, especially not from no hoop snake bite. It's better to get your head blowed off." Ma kneeled down next to me, grabbed both my shoulders, and looked hard in my eyes. "Lijah Freeman, you listen, and you listen good. Ain't nothing in the world worth being that afeard of, son. Nothing." I said, "What about toady frogs? How come you're so afeard of them? How's that any different?" Ma couldn't hardly tolerate even hearing the word toady frog. She'd near die if she ran up on one. But just like that, the conversating was over. Ma stood up, smacked the back of my head, opened the door, then said, "They is different. Them things is known to pass on warts and all other sorts of nasty diseases. And don't be back-talking me neither, Lijah Freeman. I ain't so scared of toady frogs that I'm gonna be running down the road in the middle of the day screaming my head off like you just done." She kneeled back next to me. "Acting that way don't look good on no child old as you is, Lijah. You got to learn to get control of yourself and quit being so fragile, sweetheart." Ma started acting like she couldn't decide if she was going to be nice to me or give me a good swatting. She ran her hand along my cheek and said in a kind way, "I don't know what I'm going to do about that, Zephariah. I done asked you over and over not to have no dealings with him, Lijah. He need to be ashamed of himself, scaring young folk with them nonsense stories." She was still acting friendly and peaceable when she said, "And you poor thing, you got to stop thinking things through. You got to try hard to understand if what folks are telling you make any kind of sense." Then just like that, she's back at being mad at me. She pinched my cheek hard and said, "But that ain't no excuse for you to be acting all fragile like you done. None at all." She squozed on my shoulders, 'cause being fragile's the biggest bone Ma's got to pick with me. There ain't nothing in the world she wants more than for me to quit being so doggone fragile. It's something I'm aiming to do myself, but the trouble is, me and her have two different ways of doing it, and her way always seems to be the exact backside of mine. Whilst I try not to be fragile by sucking down the looseness and sloppiness in my nose when they come, and by not screaming and running off at the littlest nonsense, Ma sets about it different. Most times she tries to encourage it by talking the subject near to death, and doggone it all, learning a lesson that way just don't stick in your head. But what's worst is when Ma quits talking and starts doing something to make a lesson permanent. The first time she tried to make me quit being fragile, I didn't even know she was doing it. But that's one lesson that stuck with me so good that it seems like it happened yesterday, and not a long time ago. Ma had been walking me round the yard near our truck patch, and I must have been mighty young, 'cause I had my arm stretched way over my head to hold on to her hand. I remember stopping to get a good look at a pile of dirt that was being scampered on by a bunch of bugs. I couldn't understand how things that small could be moving all by themselves. I dug my toes down into the dirt to make Ma quit walking so as I could get a better look. It turned out to be one of the biggest mistakes I ever made. I can recall squinting my eyes to look up at Ma and seeing her pull off her sunbonnet and wipe her forehead afore she squatted down next to me and said, "Lijah, that ain't nothing but an anthill, sweetheart." I reached out to pick one of the ants up. This was afore I'd learnt that bugs have ways of discouraging you from touching them. But afore I could get hold of one, Ma grabbed my hand. Lijah. They some of God's hardest workers, and just 'cause you's bigger, don't make it right to mess with them. Then she said, "Ooh, Lijah, look at there. Ain't that the prettiest thing?" She turned my hand loose and reached over in the grass and pulled out the most terrifying creature that ever lived. It was twisting and whipping in a way that weren't one bit normal, and it didn't have an arm nor leg nowhere on it. It looked like it came straight out your worst nightmare. But the fearfulest thing about it was that it was right in Ma's hand, which up to then had been the best place to run if there was any kind of trouble. Ma always counts that as the first time I ran off screaming. But who wouldn't have? Near everything I learnt about snakes on that day, and every day since, shows that screaming and running from them ain't one bit at all fragile. It's sensical. It weren't but a week or two later that me and Cuda were down at the river and he yelled, "Oh, ho!" Then snatched out a toady frog big as a pie pan. I was still smarting about the way Maud made me feel fragile. So the first thing that came to mind was how fragile she'd get if she saw a toady frog as big and round as this one. Like most real good ideas, this one didn't come to us right off. One thing led to the another, and after a while, me and Cuda came up with this plan that's got toady frogs and Ma and her sewing basket all meeting up together. In Sabbath school, Mr. Travis is always telling us that the Lord loves laughter. And what could be funnier than watching Ma reaching down into her basket and getting a little surprise? After supper, I wrapped the toady frog in the sweater Ma had been working on and put it in her knitting basket and ran across the road to hide in the drainage ditch with Cuda. Then, just like they always do, Ma and Pa came and sat in their rockers on the stoop, getting ready to do some relaxing. They're laughing and carrying on, and Ma put her sewing basket in her lap. She took her knitting spectacles out of the basket, then quick closed it to make a point about something with Paul. She acted like she was set to reach in and pull her knitting out, but stopped at the last instance to slap at Pa's arm. She even set the basket back on the floor, and doggone it all, it seemed her and Pa weren't going to get nothing done but talking and laughing. I was this close to losing my mind. Finally, Ma put the basket back in her lap and reached in. She knowed right off something was wrong, 'cause with that toady frog added to it, her sweater weighed about 5 pounds more than the last time she touched it. She twisted her head to the side to look at Pa, unwrapped the toady frog, and it dropped smack down in her lap. She froze up for about 1 second, then jumped straight out the rocker. Yarn and needles and buttons and the toady frog and the half-knit sweater flewed all over the stoop, like your guts do after you've been hoop-snake bit. Ma's knitting spectacles jumped partway up her forehead, and she started hopping up and down and slapping at her skirt like it's a fire. The whole time, she didn't scream nor say a word. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my life. Me and Cuda near about died peeking out of the ditch. It can't be good for you to try to keep a laugh inside. I was this close to busting clean apart. Ma heard us trying to smother our laughs down and stared across the road. She looked like she was fixing to say something, but her mouth just opened and shut over and over. Didn't no words come out, so she walked all a-shaking into the house. Pa called over to me and Cuda, "Don't y'all move." He set Ma's rocker back up, then collected all her knitting tools and put them back in the basket. He picked up the toady frog and brung him across the road right at me and Cuda. He set the toady frog down, shook his head and said, "Now, Elijah, you, me, and Cuda all thought that that was funny. Your ma and that there toady frog ain't likely to see the whole adventure quite the same way." Me and Cuda tried to keep our faces serious whilst Pa was talking, but tears were rolling down both our cheeks. Pa said, "Past a wart or two, I don't think the toady frog's gonna cause you no grieving, but your ma..." He whistled low and long. "She's a whole nother story. So whilst you's out here rolling about in that ditch enjoying the tormentation you caused your ma and that toady frog, why don't you save us all some trouble and go in them woods and break off whichever switch it is you wants her to beat you with? 'Cause you know, the next time you and her is in the same room together, that's what's gonna happen." "Cuda," Pa said, "today your lucky day, son. You's about to get 2 shows for the price of one. If you thought that there was funny, you just wait till you see the way Elijah starts a-hopping and screaming once his ma lays that switch on his behind." Pa smiled, then walked away. Me and Cuda had to run near a mile before we figured we were far enough away to really let our laughs rip out. And rip out they did. I ain't never laughed so hard. We fell all over ourselves and couldn't bear to stand up. We rolled and rolled whilst talking about the way Mom looked when she opened that sweater. We couldn't neither one of us get a whole sentence out. I said, "Did you see the way?" Then I commenced choking. Cuda said, and she, and started pulling at the grass and slapping at the ground. Then I said, "I never knowed Ma could jump so," and the laughing closed my throat right up. Once me and Cuda were all laughed out and commenced walking home, things changed. A gloom started creeping over me, the same way clouds all of a sudden start sliding up to cover a full moon. Cuda was whistling and still laughing every once in a while, and doggone it all, I saw how unfair this whole commotion was turning out to be. He'd got just as much fun from everything that happened as I did. But it looked like I was going to be the only one that had to do any kind of paying for the enjoying. I started working up a good apology, filled up with lots of sincereness for when I saw Ma. When I got home, Ma didn't say a word.
She must have thought the whole thing was too embarrassing and couldn't see no way of buking me without bringing up the subject of toady frogs again. So she let it go. I gotta say, I was real proud of Ma, because of the good way she took the toady frog joke.
It's funny. Just when you think you can't admire your folks no more than you already do, something like that happens and lets you know you're wrong.
2 days later, I got back from helping Mr. Leroy down on Mrs. Holton's land. Ma and Pa were sitting on the stoop. Ma was back to working on that sweater, and Pa was whittling away. She must have baked. The cookie jar was sitting twixt them. She said, "How Mr. Leroy doing, son?"
"He's good, ma'am."
"You stop in and give my regards to Mrs. Holton?"
"Yes, ma'am. She told me to ask about you. Mrs. Brown come by, asked if you's going to go fishing tomorrow." "Yes, ma'am, right after my stable chores."
"She done some baking, too. Say she hoping to trade for two of them big perch." It weren't Ma that baked. It was Mrs. Brown. This made the bacon in the cookie jar a lot more interesting.
"What she bake, Ma?"
Ma reached down and picked up the cookie jar. She said, "You know how Mrs. Brown is, Lijah, always trying something new. She baked some sugar cookies and some other kind of cookies she call..." Ma quit knitting and looked over her spectacles at Pa.
"Ooh, Spencer, I must be getting old. I can't for the life of me recall what she said they was, can you?"
Pa held up on his whittling, looked at her, and said, "No, darling, I can't recall neither." Ma slapped the arm of her rocker.
"Oh, yes, now I remember. She baked them walnut and sugar cookies and something she say she gonna call rope cookies. You's lucky they some left. Was all I could do to keep your daddy out of them."
She tipped the cookie jar toward Pa, and he reached in and pulled out a cookie that had walnuts stuck to the top of it and sugar dusted all over it. Pa bit on the cookie and said,
"Almost as good as yourn, sir."
He winked at me. Ma leaned the jar at me, but just as I was about to reach in, she pulled it back and said,
"Now, Lijah, you know better than that. You've been working hard with Mr. Leroy. Go wash up first, son."
"Yes, ma'am."
I ran round to the back stoop to wash my hands quick as I could. When I came out front, Ma tipped the cookie jar at me again, and I dug my hand right in. Ma was right. It felt like Pa'd et near all of them. But as I moved my hand round in the bottom of the jar, I felt one of them rope cookies. And Mrs. Brown must have just brung these cookies over, because the last one left was still warm. I pulled the cookie out of the jar. My heart quit beating. My blood ran cold. And time stood still. My fingers were wrapped round the neck of the worst-looking snake in Canada West. I screamed, "Snake!" And before I knowed it, I was tearing off across the road into the woods. By the time I wore myself out, I must have run 2 miles. I stopped and leaned against a tree, waiting for my breathing to catch up to me. Something made me look down at my hand. I screamed, "Snake!" for the second time. But this time, I remembered to turn the snake's neck loose and throwed it down. I wouldn't have thought I had enough strength left in me to run, but being afeared and being tired looked like two things you can't feel at the same time. When I ran back up on our stoop, Ma's and Pa's faces were wet with tears. Pa was leaning over the side of his rocker like he's having a fit. I'd been so afeared and trusted my folks so much that it didn't come to me till right then that that snake hadn't crawled into the cookie jar on his own. He must have had some help. It was a true shock when I figured out Ma was setting this whole thing up as a lesson. When my voice finally came back, I said, "Ma, how could you do that?" They rolled. Pa fought to catch his breathing.
"Well, Lijah, seemed to me, what sauce for the goose
is sauce for the gander.
It's a horrible feeling when the people who are supposed to raise you go out of their way to scare you for no good reason, and making it worse was that they were getting so much enjoying out of it. Besides, fair's fair, and scaring your ma with something as harmless as a toady frog calls for getting switched, not getting terrified.
Why would you do that?
I was crying so hard that the words were getting choked down in my throat. Ma, you're always telling me I can dish it out, but I can't take it. So if you know that, how could you do this to me? And besides that, you know how much I hate snakes.
Mm-hmm. About the same amount that I hate toady frogs.
But Ma, toady frogs ain't nothing. Snakes are dangerous. 'Twa'n't no toady frog that gave Adam and Eve an apple, 'twas a snake. And you ain't never heard of nothing called a hoop toady frog, have you? No, that's 'cause they're harmless. It's snakes what'll kill you.
Pa was slapping his side so hard, it's a wonder he didn't bust no ribs. You couldn't do nothing but expect that kind of rudeness from him. But the way Ma was carrying on was terrible shocking.
Ma! I thought we were trying to make it so I wouldn't be so fragile. Look at me. I can't quit shaking.
I could see I was wasting my breath. If people could die from laughing too hard, I'd be an orphan. I know it probably ain't right to feel this way about your old ma and pa, but I was sore disappointed in the way they were acting. Before I got in bed that night, I even used a stick to flip my pillow over. I was so shooked up that I wanted to make sure Ma weren't going to carry on this lesson no further.
Chapter 2. Me and Mr. Frederick Douglass.
About the only good thing that came from Ma's snake in the cookie jar lesson was there weren't no one else around to see it, not even Cuda. It wouldn't have been no time at all afore everyone in the settlement knowed about what happened. And even if Cuda and me are best friends, and he wouldn't do nothing to on purpose make me look low, I knowed that me running off from that snake like I done was such a good story that even a best friend couldn't have been blamed for letting it accidentally slip out, especially a best friend like Cuda. The whole adventure would just turn into another one of them things that would be stuck onto my name forever. And doggone it all, seems like what people enjoy sticking to your name permanent ain't never good things. They're always tragical. I ain't the kind of person that complains for no reason, but I gotta say, I already got one tragedy tied up with my name that is so horrible that it wouldn't be one bit fair that I'd get another. The tragedy that's so horrible put a scar on me that I'm gonna be carrying to the day I die. You'd think grown folks would cry when they saw me, but that don't happen at all. Even Ma and Pa try to act like it ain't all that noticeable and that they ain't ashamed to have folks see they're raising me. But I know better. It happened when I weren't nothing but a baby, and I can't see why I'm to blame. But that's when the famousest, smartest man who ever escaped from slavery stood on a tall stage that had got built in the schoolhouse and raised me way up over his head in front of a crowd of people. From the way Paul tells it, the man must have had me 20 feet up in the air. He was giving a speech when the accident happened, 'cause every time he made a point, he'd give me a little shake way up there over top of his head. I weren't even a year old back when Mr. Frederick Douglass and Mr. John Brown visited Buxton. Paul said all the settlement people had got excited and worked up something terrible about them coming and were dashing around trying to polish Buxton up. Sort of like the way you'd rub the dirt off your Sunday shoes if you knowed Mr. Travis was going to give him a hard look. They rushed to get the new schoolhouse finished so's there'd be a place big enough for the meeting. They made sure the picket fences in front of everyone's home had got a good slap of whitewash on them. They made all kinds of food and such, and they even had a special blanket made out of sewed-together flowers to go cross Flapjack the Mule's back
so as he could lead a parade. All this fussing was going on because folks in Buxton were going to celebrate three special people at this big meeting. Special person number one was Mr. Frederick Douglass, because he used to be a slave, just like most of the folks here in Buxton. And now they say he can talk the bees out of flying to the flowers. Special person number two was Mr. John Brown, because folks say, other than maybe Reverend King, the man who started Buxton, there weren't no white man ever made that was better than him. And special person number three was me, because it ain't something I ever boast on, but I was the very first child to be born free in the Elgin settlement at Raleigh in Canada West, what we call Buxton. Mrs. Guest, who's the best sewer and knitter in the settlement, had even gone and knitted some fancy clothes for me that Ma still keeps in a peculiar-smelling box made out of cedar wood. Me and Ma have a pretty good disagreement about them clothes, 'cause to me, they look a powerful lot like a girl's dress and bonnet. When I got grown enough to understand what it was they'd paraded me round in, I was just as much shamed about the clothes they forced me to wear as I was about the accident twixt me and special person number one. Paul said everything was all right with the celebrating until the parade got to the schoolhouse and most of the speechifying was over. That's when Mr. Douglass came and took me from Ma, walked high up on the stage with me, and held me up in the air over his head. Ma said she was worrying right off, 'cause Mr. Douglass is an excitable man when he gets talking, and he started bouncing me up and down and swinging me around with joy, saying I was a shining beacon of light and hope for the future. I asked Ma what that meant, and she couldn't say. Don't seem to me that getting called a piece of meat off of a pig is anything that you should get excited about. But Mr. Douglass thought it was great, and folks kept cheering, and he kept tossing me up and down till the accident happened. Ma says even back then I was a fragile child, and the more he tossed me, the more she was fretting. She said I was having a whole lot of fun, then I smiled real big, and without no kind of warning at all, the accident happened. I throwed up everything I'd et all over Mr. Douglass's beard and jacket. I learnt from Ma that people who used to be slaves love prettying up any kind of story. She says talking is near the only thing they used to get to do, without no white person telling them how or when, so they make the most of it once they get the chance. She says they love making a summer day a lot hotter than it really was, or making rain or drought last a whole lot longer than they really did. And they especially love telling you how their great-great-grandpa or grandma used to be the king or queen of Africa. Bad as my luck is, the people that live in Buxton ain't choose to pretty up the fact I'm most proud of myself for, my rock chucking. They've prettified what happened twixt me and Mr. Frederick Douglass. They'll tell you I throwed up on Mr. Douglass for a whole half an hour afore Ma came and snatched me away and pointed me out the schoolhouse window. They say I near drowned the man. Some folks swear I throwed up so hard that desks and chairs rose up and floated out of the schoolhouse. Mr. Polite said I throwed up so plentiful that didn't no deers nor rabbits die in the woods for 5 years after. He said the bears and the wolves ate my vomit for that long, since it was considerable easier for them to do that than to try to run down some animal that weren't looking to get ate. And that don't make no sense. That don't make no sense at all. First off, 'cause they're always telling us how smart Mr. Frederick Douglass is. They tell us he can talk Greek like a Greek and Latin like a Latin. And anyone who's that smart ain't going to sit and hold no baby over his head that's throwing up on him for no whole half an hour. I could understand it if he was surprised at first. Ain't no one going to expect to get throwed up on by a baby boy in a girl's dress and bonnet. But if Mr. Douglass is near as smart as folks say, seems to me he'd have had the sense to aim me out the window hisself. Seems to me if I really did throw up for a whole half an hour, Only the first 5 minutes would have been on Mr. Douglas. The last 20 minutes would have had to be out that window.
It also don't make no sense about the bears and wolves neither, because if they were coming into the settlement 3 times a day to eat what I'd throwed up, this would have been a mighty unsafe place. But did none of the grown folks act worried about sending their children off to do no chores?
Back when I was about 5 or 6, Ma told me to fetch a bucket and go into the woods behind our home and pick her some blueberries. This is probably one of the reasons Ma thinks I'm a fragile boy. I remember soon she told me to go, I got all afeared and shakety. I said, "By myself?" She said, "It ain't that far, Elijah. I'm gonna keep watch over you."
"But, Ma, what about all those bears and wolves? What if I'm out there when they come for their supper?"
She smiled and said, "Elijah, don't be silly. Ain't no wild creatures like that been seen round these parts since afore you was born." I said, "But, Ma, how come everybody keeps telling me about what I done to Mr. Douglas that got all the bears and wolves coming to the settlement looking for something to eat?"
She laughed and told me some of that grown folks talk. Some of that talk that makes it so's you ain't never sure about much of nothing. She said, "Son, you got one of them sets of mind what's going to have you fretting about the littlest things. Life's going to be a tough road to hoe for you if you don't learn you can't be believing everything folks tell you. Not even grown folks."
1 minute, Ma, who's got a good head for thinking, tells me I got to respect everything what grown folks say. In the next minute, she's wanting me not to believe some of the things the same grown folks tell me. If that don't leave you scratching your head, you got a better brain than me.
Chapter 3. Fish Head Chunking.
It was Friday evening, and I finished my lessons at school and started walking to the stable to do my chores. I was going to have to work faster than I do most days because a bunch of people were counting on me to bring them some fish. Mr. Segee was next to the barn, raking through his truck patch.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Segee."
"Why, hello there, Elijah. I always can tell when you're on your way. Old Flapjack get worked up about 15 minutes before you gets here."
"I don't know why people say horses and mules are dull, Mr. Segee. Especially old Flapjack. He's got to be the smartest mule ever."
Mr. Segee snorted like he thought I'd lost my mind.
"Well, it's good you here, boy. Now go on in. Them animals is waiting on you."
I separate my chores at the stable into 2 parts. The working part and the enjoying part. The working part is doing the things you wouldn't do unless you were forced to. I get them done first. Things like cleaning the stalls and shoveling manure and taking it to the fertilizer pile and feeding and watering the animals. This takes a considerable good amount of time. The second part of my chores, the enjoying part, is divided into brushing the animals, tending to their hoofs, and my favorite part, helping make them comforted by keeping the horse flies off of them. It weren't just for their good that this was my favoriteest job. I was getting something out of it, too. I was getting flies to use for bait. I figured out that this chore fit right in with the Buxton Settlement Creed. One helping one to uplift all. It's the way all us in the settlement look out for one another. We don't expect nothing in return, but if we see someone that needs a hand, we rush to give it. Good things always come from that. I got my fly swa, pulled a milking stool next to old Flapjack, and waited. It weren't long before a good-sized fly lit just above his rear hoof. Crack! Blang it all! I ain't the type to make the mistake of cursing out loud like that, but sometimes swear words will jump out of you afore you have a chance to remember they ain't proper. Those words came out of me from being frustrated. I weren't swatting flies just for the sake of killing them, and sometimes I got a little too strong. I've been swatting horse flies for so many years that I could tell by the sound the fly swall made once it hit if I was going to be able to use the fly for fishing or not. And crack was a sound that most times weren't too good. I looked under old Flapjack, and I was right. The fly was in the dust, and nothing was moving on him except for the green guts that were leaking out of his bust-up back end. I picked him up by his wings, blew him off, and dropped him in the dead pouch. Two more horseflies landed on old Flapjack's flank, and it was a chance to make up for the mistake I'd just made. I mean, the hitting the fly too hard mistake, not the swearing mistake. Mr. Travis tells us that swearing's the kind of mistake that once you do it, there ain't no way to make up for it. I studied the two horseflies that had landed on old Flap real careful. When a couple of them land close together like this, it ain't long afore they take notice of one another and quit seeing anything else. It's kind of like they put a spell or a conjure on each other, and, truth told, once they do, it's easier to hit two at once than it is to hit one. The two flies saw each other at near the same time and froze their moving, trying to see which one was toughest. This weren't the right thing to do, 'cause weren't neither one of them tough as my fly swall, and it was about to do a whole lot more bad to them than any other horse fly ever could. Padop! Now that was a good sound. That meant I hadn't hit him hard enough to break no fly bones or nothing. But I had hit them so's they were going to be a little dumbstruck. Most likely, they wouldn't be doing no more flying, but they should still be alive and kicking. I looked under the mule again, and there they were, wings still a-buzzing, and each one of them spinning in circles on the ground, raising up two little clouds of dust. I quick snatched them up and put them in the live pouch with the other ones that I was going to use for big fish bait. The preacher will tell anyone that listens that the biggest, most ornery horseflies in the world live right here in Buxton. Mostly he tells the new free slaves that come here because he don't love nothing more than letting them know how amazing him and the rest of us folks in Buxton are. But truth told, it's mostly how amazing he is. One time, seven free slaves came into the settlement all at once, and the preacher took it on himself to welcome them. This was afore the elders found out what he was doing and quick made sure it didn't happen again. He told those seven new free people about what difficult days were ahead.
"Winters," he shouted at them, "and your worst nightmares. You can't imagine how bad the winters up here are. Got so cold during the winter of 53... that flames on candles froze solid. Even the sun was frozen in place halfway across the sky. It didn't thaw out or commence moving again till the summer of 54, 7 months of nothing but sunlight. Which explains why the horseflies up here are unnaturally large and ornery, since they had two growing seasons instead of the usual one." The preacher liked waving his arms round whilst he was talking, and he was really going at it to try to impress these new folks. "I was out in the field plowing with my mule that summer," he said, which should have let on that this was going to be a powerful stretching of the truth, "'cause don't no one round here ever recall seeing the reins of a mule nor any other kind of working tool in the preacher's hands. When suddenly these two horseflies start buzzing overhead, and one asks the other, 'What do you think? Should we eat that mule here, or drag him into the woods and polish him off?' The second fly says, 'Let's eat him here. If we take him to the woods, the full-grown horseflies will snatch him away from us.' I ain't seen no signs of horseflies that big round here, but it could be true. The preacher's a mighty smart man. I only know that the fish at old Flapjack's lake sure do think these horseflies are the best eating they've ever done." Once I got enough flies and checked round the stable to make sure I'd done everything, I went back out to Mr. Segee,
Everything's done, Mr. Segee.
Elijah, when you says everything's done, ain't no need for me to check. Ain't none the other children look after that stable the way you do.
When's your next day? A Monday, sir.
Well, then, see you on Monday.
Yes, sir. Sir, is it going to be all right if I take old Flapjack out for a spell?
It was the same thing every Friday, and he never said no. But Ma and Pa always say it's polite and proper to ask and not to make no assumptions.
Why, let me think a second, boy. Is it all right for you to take that old mule out?
Mr. Segee leaned on the rake he was using and kind of stared up into the clouds. Then he said,
I think they done called off the horse racing for this evening, Elijah. Seemed like all them horses, even Jingle Boy and Conqueror, done pulled out once they got wind old Flapjack was running again. Figure they ain't got no chance at whooping that mule, so it don't seem like you taking him is going to be a problem.
Mr. Segee came up from Mississippi only a year ago, and Maul says we got to give him some allowance for the kind of things he thinks is funny. So I give him a little laugh every time he makes one of them bad jokes. I could tell Flapjack was raring to go, but lest you knowed what to look for, you might not see it. His raring to go looks a powerful lot like his not wanting to move look. Soon's I led him out of the stable, he started off on the road that runs through the main part of the settlement. I knowed there weren't no rush to catch him. I knowed exactly where he was going. Once he got out of the stable, he'd head straight down the road afore he cut off into the woods, heading for the lake he first took me to about a year ago. I had plenty of time to put away the tools and the wheelbarrow and gather up my fly pouches and my chunking stones and my net basket and the strings that I use for holding the fish I catch. When I got done, I cut through some fields and caught old Flapjack just as he passed Miss Carolina's house. I jumped on his back and let him carry me to our secret lake. Most folks say it's wrong, but if I had my druthers, I'd ride a mule over a horse any day. Horses do too much shaking of your insides when you ride them, and they're a long way up if you lose your grip and fall. Mules don't jar nothing when they walk. They like slow and easy travel. They have a way of rocking you gentle, like a baby in a crib. If you don't fall asleep first, you get a chance to think about things when you ride a mule. With a horse, you don't get to think about nothing but hoping you don't fall off and get cold-cocked by their hoofs. If you fall off a mule, you're already close to the ground and got plenty of time to roll out of the way of their feet. Slow as old Flapjack is, if you fell off him, you'd have time enough to take a nap before you had to worry about him stomping on you. Flapjack left the road and turned off into the woods just after we crossed out of the settlement and passed the preacher's house. It didn't look like the preacher was home. Not that I'd have stopped and called on him. It's just that lately, since he's seen Jesus has been giving me gifts, he lets me come with him and watch when he practices shooting off his mystery pistol. It was just last month that the preacher snuck up on me whilst I was out in the Atlas clearing, chunking rocks. He came out from behind a tree and said, "Did I see what I think I saw? Or are my eyes deceiving me?" He sounded so surprised that I looked round the clearing expecting something peculiar to be going on.
"What did you see, sir?"
The preacher said, "I saw you, Elijah. I saw what you were doing, and I'm afraid it has the look of conjuring to it." I couldn't understand what he was talking about. I was sure I hadn't done nothing that no one could claim was conjuring. I said, "No, sir. I would never do nothing like conjuring. I wasn't doing nothing but chunking stones." He said, "That's what I'm talking about. I've never seen a soul throw a rock like you do, and, Elijah, I have to tell you,
I'm quite concerned. I have to do some serious pondering on this to see if it's the work of the devil.
You do know that being left-handed is one of the sure signs of being in Satan's clutches, don't you?
I said, no, sir. He said, keep that in mind. Come on with me. I'm going a little deeper in the woods to practice shoot. And bring some of those rocks you have there.
I told Ma I wasn't going to go no farther than the Atlas clearing. But since I was going to be with the preacher, I figured it'd be all right if I followed him. Besides, if it meant I'd get to see him shooting off his mystery pistol, weren't nothing going to stop me.
I'd spent lots of time sneaking through the woods, mostly at night. But I didn't recognize the way the preacher started leading me. All I knowed for sure was that it was where me and Coot had been warned not to go, off toward the way where some of the white people that didn't like us lived. Pod told us it was a way full up with black bears and bats, and worst of all, millions of rattling snakes. I sure was glad the preacher had his gun, 'cause, truth told, whilst I knowed I wouldn't have no trouble chunking a rattling snake with my rocks, I can't say for sure if I could stop one of those black bears. Me and the preacher must have walked for a half an hour, but I couldn't be sure when you don't know where you're heading. Time don't seem to run by like it normal do. But with every step we took, I was getting more and more disappointed in this new area. From the way Pa had warned me, I'd always pictured these woods as having so many bears hanging out of the trees that the sunlight would have been blocked off from hitting the ground. I'd always pictured that there'd be so many rattling snakes hissing and shaking in these parts that you'd near about go deaf from the racket they made. But we'd been walking a good long time, and there was still plenty of sunlight, and I hadn't heard rattle the first. We hadn't even seen one bat. Finally, we got to another clearing, and the preacher said, I'm going to give you some tests, Elijah. And I'm hoping that they prove you haven't been conjuring, because if you have, it's my responsibility to let the word be spread. I weren't sure what he meant by that, but I knowed it weren't good. He said, I'm going to set these pieces of wood up at about 20 paces, and I want to see how many of them you can hit. I started thinking this over. Hitting something from 20 paces weren't nothing, but I wondered if I should miss one or two of them on purpose so's the preacher wouldn't see no signs of conjuring. But this was the preacher, and he was so smart it'd be hard to fool him. He was always telling me he'd forgot more than I ever knowed, which don't make a lot of sense, but it was probably going to be best on me if I chunked for real and didn't hold back. The preacher walked off 20 steps and set up 5 hunks of wood about 3 feet apart, one from the other. He came back and told me, let me see how many of them you can hit before I count 5. I put 2 stones in my right hand and 3 in my left. The preacher raised an eyebrow like he had never seen nothing like this and said, set, go. 1. I throwed left, right, left, right, left. The preacher had only counted to 3 before I had all 5 of those wood hunks flying through the air. He looked at me in a way that told me he thought for sure I was a conjuring. He didn't say nothing, but he walked back the 20 paces and this time set up 10 pieces of wood. He came back and drawed his mystery pistol out of its fancy holster and said, when I say go, you hit the 5 on the right, and I'm going to hit the 5 on the left. I got my rocks ready. Go! The loud way the pistol exploded right next to me throwed me off, and I missed the first piece of wood, but quick knocked down the others. By the time I'd finished, the preacher had only shot 3 of the wood hunks and was sighting in on number 4. He stopped
and looked at me like he's puzzling, then said,
"I'm going to have to do some more contemplating over this. On the one hand, this might be an act of conjuration.